coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM. It's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, 2 hours of, wait and see, and you'll find out. It's our endless attempt to regain civil rights in Santa Cruz. Stay tuned. We're not dead, we're just sleeping, so don't go away. But sleeping a bit too soundly, it appears. We've got to do a little quick shifting around here. The tape that I thought was working is not working as well as it should be. So let's grab a little something else here and see what we've got. Here's a little song. It'll start us off from Spare and Change, Sitting Pretty with Mr. Paradise. Let's hear how this sounds. And that was, if I've got it right, Safe and Sound from Spare and Change, Sitting Pretty with Mr. Paradise. Copyright 1999. I think this is a street disc I picked up downtown some years ago. I'll be hearing a little bit more from Spare and Change. As some people do spare a little change. It's a nice thing. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And the subject matter that I talk about is civil rights here in Santa Cruz. What's the status? How do we deal with issues of police abuse and merchant and resident persecution and harassment of poor people and institutional harassment of poor people, the kind of increasing crunch that's happening as the economic crisis deepens? I particularly focus on the petty laws that the Santa Cruz City Council has passed, and I play a lot of interviews from the street, which describes experiences of individuals on the street. And I'm going to begin today's show, which is a call-in show, by the way, and I'll be giving the call-in number in a moment, so feel free to call in if you want, with an interview with attorney Jonathan Gettleman. It's actually a discussion the two of us had around legal issues about a particular case that's kind of dear to my heart because it concerns a $445 ticket that I got for singing political songs downtown in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. Three other people were ticketed with me, and what I've talked about at great length in past shows as being another example of the kind of increasing crackdown we're facing downtown. We were engaged in a homeless protest, dramatizing the homeless deaths of the previous year, signing up people to volunteer to help in various ways, and protest various laws, such as the sleeping ban law in Santa Cruz, which criminalizes sleeping after 11 o'clock at night for people outside. And Jonathan Gettleman is an attorney who's taken on the case of two homeless musicians. Actually, one, he's covering one, and Mark Briscoe is covering the other. Anna Richardson is his client, his pro bono or client. That means he's not getting any money from her. She doesn't have any money. And as regular listeners know, and folks who've been following the show or following the Santa Cruz Sentinel, although it hasn't been much in the papers recently, Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon are accused of sleeping downtown, and they have been banned by a very peculiar court order, which you'd think, why do they need a court order when they have a sleeping ban law already that makes it illegal? Well, you just get a ticket if you sleep downtown, but if you get a court order, then they can arrest you. And that seems to be what the, they haven't arrested them yet, although I understand they have on a number of occasions violated that court order. At least that's the rumor I've heard. But it's a pretty ominous feature of sort of the increasing repression that's going on downtown, that we had fought to make sleeping, if not legal, at least not a crime punishable by jail. But now it is punishable by jail for these two, and Jonathan Gettleman is one of the attorneys fighting this. He was giving me some tips on how to deal with the case that I had, which had to do with, has to do with, still going to court in March or April. We haven't got a court date yet. The question of can a person who doesn't like the sound of your music, singing, and protest get you arrested for, quote, unreasonably disturbing noises in the middle of the day? That's really the issue. So here's some of this interview, and I invite you to call in. I told you I'd give you the number, and I will. 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772 is the call-in number here, and I will take calls. And I can also pick up any messages or concerns off-air that you might have. The number for that is 423-4833, 423-HUFF. HUFF is also an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, civil rights group I generally have weekly meetings with, though this week I was under the weather and I'm still recovering a bit, but hopefully doing better. It meets every Wednesday, 10:30 in the morning, at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific, and everyone's invited. We provide coffee. You provide hard luck stories and stories of what's happening on the streets. And also some volunteer to do something about it. Anyway, here's a discussion I had with Attorney Jonathan Gettleman on a number of legal issues, which I think might be of interest.
Making some notes, it's January 26th. I'm here with Jonathan Gettleman, and Jonathan's pointing out that we're looking over the unreasonably disturbing noises ticket that four of us got, and he points out that one, it's unreasonable for the complainant to believe that he should be able to sleep undisturbed from 1:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon with the window open,
and
that the public should have to comply individually, keep their noises down, and that the noise itself, so therefore, is in order for it to be lawfully the necessary activity. It is a political protest. It is a song. It does require to be heard from a certain distance, and therefore, so some projection is necessary. And the real question is whether there were any significant complaints. Now, the other issue that I would have here is:
was the projection of that message unreasonably loud so that it wasn't necessary in connection with the activity? But what's important to note is that in order to get the message across, it is necessary to project that message publicly. So in that sense, the projection of the message is necessary in connection with that activity.
Right.
It's otherwise lawfully conducted.
And of course, the issue will also be whether it disturbed anyone else in the area, whether there were any other complaints. And with respect to the police officer who took this complaint and found that there was, presumably, that there was probable cause to take the complaint as a citizen arrest, not just as a complaint.
Based on the accusation alone.
Based on the accusation and that of one witness who was with this person, who was also up in the room, as I believe. But over the objections of a number of other people who were listening or performing, and not with any apparent research, let's say, asking the other people nearby whether there was a problem. There may be police reports here that could be useful to find out what's going on, a kind of pretrial discovery.
So the limited investigation of the officer may become an issue when there were other people that were willing to give statements that may have indicated against writing the citation.
Right. In fact,
for the officer's credibility.
I did attempt repeatedly to make a complaint of a false police report, which would lead to my making a statement about further facts in the case. The police officer initially promised to take the report, and then later specifically said she would not do that because she didn't believe it was a false police report. Also, when the officer arrived, she said, she directed we stop singing, and she then told us that unless we moved, not got quieter, but moved, we would be given a citation by the citizen, not by her, but by the citizen through her. And we said, well, you know, we are willing to quiet down if necessary because we want to be respectful even if it's not necessary legally, but we're not going to move. This is our protest. We got our sign set up here, our table. We're feeding food here to people, hot soup, or we were.
So it may be worth subpoenaing the training policies of the police department to determine what their training is and sensitivity to First Amendment speech and activity, particularly on Pacific Avenue, which is the main venue for public expression in Santa Cruz County.
You pointed out that Pacific Avenue is the main and the busiest street in town. There may be other streets where traffic moves faster. I'm sure there are, but this is certainly one of the main thoroughfares.
Important to note that it's the main, aside from maybe the courthouse itself, it's the main public venue for speech activity. Whether or not it's the most populous is less consequential than the fact that it is used as the primary venue for expression.
I gather that. I was also noting you're noting that it's not reasonable for people to believe that this would be a quiet street, that they would be entitled, let's say, to sleep peacefully and quietly in the middle of the day with the window open from the second story, which is where they were.
Yeah, I think that, reasonably speaking, everyone has rights to be able to sleep at the time usually set aside for sleeping. And then there is an ordinance that kicks in, I believe, after 10 o'clock.
Except homeless people don't get allowed that, right? Because they're different kind of people, as you know.
If they even are people, right?
They're not really people. They are, but, you know, we try to avoid that. So the real issue that you brought up before is how can we, once they dismiss this ticket or find it not guilty, how can we actually get a broader kind of ruling from a court or get the police department to change their policy regarding taking citizen arrests?
Well,
of this kind.
It appears as though the problem here is with enforcement, not the language of the statute. The language of the statute on its face seems to be constitutional, and it seems to be limited. The problem seems to be that it is being used in such a manner that otherwise causes conflict with a greater right, which is the First Amendment. And while the First Amendment can be limited in scope, time, manner, and place in the way that's set forth in the statute, the fact that that limitation does exist does not mean that officers are allowed to indiscriminately take any complaint and therefore stop the speech. The stopping of the speech is a civil problem and would have to be ordered, have a court order to have them cease and desist from otherwise stopping political activities under some criteria that would probably be set forth by the court. It's almost as if they are using this unreasonable disturbing noise ordinance as a
heckler's veto?
As a, what do you call it? I can't think of the word right now. It is a, I just had it, prior restraint on otherwise political speech is completely compliant with a reasonable interpretation of the noise ordinance. And so looking into prior constraint would be important because, it's somewhat analogous to denying a permit to people because other people might have a problem with the permit that would, you know, violate some ordinance or something of that nature, but you know, there has to be a balancing, and it doesn't seem like there's any weight being given to the speech side of this.
So performers up and down Pacific Avenue do have a problem with this approach because they are often poor. They may fear losing their instruments, as although police have not recently threatened taking instruments as implements of the crime. They aren't told who's complaining, how far away the complaint comes from, and they aren't given the option to play more quietly. But they're just told to move along, move away, or alternately to stop playing entirely and leave Pacific Avenue. What kind of response do you think the street performer community can make to this?
In my opinion, even though it doesn't seem this way, and it really, to some degree, isn't this way anymore, the law was established and carried out in such a manner that common people, you know, common, i.e. not professionals trained in the legal profession, have the ability to petition the court whenever they have a grievance. And if they're not, don't have enough money to pay for it, then they have the ability to get fee waivers, both for the filing of the complaint and for the conducting of the lawsuit. So particularly poor people with idle time provides a perfect opportunity for them to address their grievances with the court, and the court has a duty to research the law and make the rulings pursuant to the law. So I think it's encouraging rather than discouraging, and you know, if enough people bring enough complaints and their complaints are reasonably based, then hopefully that will influence the way that the laws are interpreted.
The performers themselves should bring complaints to the court about how the law is enforced.
Why not?
They're not very sophisticated. They're spending their time trying to eke out a living. they're afraid of police harassment. There are numerous reasons why they don't want to do it, but I think it's, you know, not necessarily a bad idea. I thought you were going to say, well, if there's a problem, the complainant against music and the performers would be best advised to go to take a civil remedy, and the police are not, in fact, empowered to run around taking the complaint of every heckler in town who doesn't like a person singing. And they could take the complaint, but they're not supposed to make a citizen's arrest of that, of those people.
Poor people, particularly homeless people, are never going to win with the police. So it's not a reasonable position, I don't think, to think that you know, people that don't want to hear homeless people singing are going to make civil complaints, and that the police are not going to enforce the law in any manner, that they feel that the, you know, nice people, quote unquote, of Santa Cruz are otherwise being dissuaded in whatever they want to do with their life by what both the police and those people making the complaints consider general nuisance.
And you might, you probably would add to that, I suspect you might add to that, that the police department, that there's no real, that the judges are going to join the police, in essence, continuing to give them the power to, and the broad discretion to issue complaints, to issue arrests and citations whenever and wherever they want, with a very broad notion of what the probable cause may or may not be.
Yeah, and that spurred a thought in me that I understand that a protest was taking place, and in this certain instance, and I understand that people's voices wanted to be heard, but sometimes your voice needs to be heard as to your ability to make those types of statements as much as it does making those statements. And that's why I just go back to the fact that if you have a grievance and your voice is being otherwise squelched, or whatever you want to say, in the public forum, then maybe you need to go to court and create the space to be able to have the time, manner, and place to make those statements in public. And if you lose, you are losing anyways with the police and whatever. But
well, you may be creating bad precedent and actually empowering further police repression.
Police are going to be repressive whether there's precedent or not. There's an ability for a court order to get them to, not them being the police, to cease and desist from what they're doing, but otherwise they're just going to do it. So I don't know how much it's going to hurt. And in terms of bad precedent, you know, to the degree that one of these cases makes it into a court of note, namely the appellate court in the state of California, to make any type of precedent, well, then by the time you get there, I'm sure somebody will become interested in your cause. And
well, I mean really local precedent. See, police officers up and down Pacific Avenue are not generally issuing citations themselves for noise complaints, which leads one to think, we use the argument, you walked past me while I was performing. You didn't think there was anything wrong with it, yet you took a complaint from somebody two blocks away when I was performing essentially at the same volume. Doesn't this indicate that you don't think there's probable cause when that a crime is being committed, but you accept that somebody else does, even though they're further away and seems less likely, and we're talking about the same incident?
That's because what we're discussing here is unreasonably disturbing noises, and certainly noises that are unreasonably disturbing two blocks away would have to be even more disturbing, I don't know, 5 feet away.
Possible interpretation. Another interpretation is that the police like to feel like there is a citizen complaint that they are giving voice to, and then the courts will figure out what the appropriate action is. The key thing to note is that the stopping of political speech in and of itself is a problem that the police are engaging in. To some degree, I don't disagree with the police that if this is a fight that two people are going to have between them, let them go to court, let the person have their venue for making their accusation, and then let the court figure out what's the best thing to do about it. The problem here, in my opinion, comes when, in so doing, the police actually stop the political speech that is otherwise going on. If they want to write a citation and keep walking, and let the speech continue, then that's you know, what they're there to do. They're there to attempt to stave off, you know, fist fighting in the streets over things like this.
So what we would try to do is the...
And, of course, I got to say that I don't entirely agree with Attorney Gettleman, who is the individual I'm talking to, and his belief that just going to court is a way to address these issues for some of the reasons I already mentioned, which is one that, you know, people don't have resources, they don't have the expertise and sophistication, they don't have the patience and sort of testimony-gathering ability, mostly because they haven't had experience with it, and there are too many other things they need to do. Plus, of course, that things are really kind of stacked against them. I think the real issue can be, to some extent, what power people have on the streets, what power people have in the community of public opinion, what power people have to protest and to raise their voices in greater numbers if this kind of practice is followed unreasonably and persistently by the police. That's traditionally what some of us have done in Santa Cruz with such laws as the sitting ban, and that's been successful on occasion. You know, it's certainly not necessarily successful all the time, but there is a potential deterrent in terms of potential lawsuits. So that stops police officers from simply wantonly, or may stop police officers from wantonly issuing citations. But the problem we have now is this practice that seems to be happening of police simply giving a blank check to hecklers, as I call them, people who are saying they're witnessing a crime, unreasonably disturbing noises, when in fact what they're witnessing is normal musical performance or political speech, and the police have no business writing citations. And I think the problem with leaving this to the courts is that while you're leaving it to the courts, the police can issue more citations, and each citation is $445. And a lot of people are just unwilling. It's too high a price for their political speech, unless you happen to be a corporation, you know, or a well-to-do person. It just doesn't work that way. So it's essentially, it acts as a form of preventive action. It deters people from engaging in free speech at all, for fear that they'll get another citation. Even if they ask the police officer, is this too loud? The police officer says, no, that's fine. If any citizen can come up and say, no, it is too loud, and get the cop to write you a ticket anyway, then you're in trouble. Instead, the police officer, and this is the point, is not using the option she or he has to say to the individual demanding the citation be written, take it to the city attorney, because I passed by and I didn't find this unreasonably disturbing noises. You're not really applying the standard of the law. However, the city attorney may disagree. You make a recording of it. You've got to, you know, get an audio recording of it or a witness and take it to the city attorney. I don't want to engage in something that is a sort of a preemptive discrimination, a form of deterring and chilling free speech from the get-go, from the gate.
True, we're not really clear what the police would have done had we continued singing. We stopped singing. Most musicians do. But there is another code section that states that if you continue this offense, or if you do it again within 48 hours, it's a misdemeanor, punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine.
Well, that might be a risk somebody has to take. People have taken greater risks.
And you would be, of course, eager to jump on board and defend that particular person.
I'm always eager. Well, able is different than eager, so we'll see.
Any updates? I'm wondering if I should play this for free radio. I might, because it sounds like it's... I don't think we're revealing any deep strategies here, do you?
No, because there's nothing that's occurred yet. We don't know what's going to happen.
So, in the case of Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon, and Ana Richardson's attorney, and you're certainly acquainted with the de Leon case, you've been seeking documents from the city attorney around their attempt to get a permanent injunction banning the two of them from sleeping in the downtown area on public property, right?
Right.
And I saw Miguel de Leon the other day. I haven't seen Ana I saw her a few days before that. I understand that, of course, they have to sleep at night. There's a controversy as to whether they will accept legal shelter or not, but there's often a shortage of legal shelter. It's not even available. You've asked the city attorney to provide certain documents. What documents have you been looking for?
Well, we're looking for any documents that could be that could lead to discoverable information in the case. And when I say that, you know, using the kind of legal vernacular, what I mean is we want to see anything relevant. We particularly want to see any types of policies or discussions that have occurred between the County Board of Supervisors, the police, and their, well, obviously not their attorneys because we wouldn't have access to that, that indicate if there...
He means the City Council, not the County Board of Supervisors, because it's the city that sought the injunction and it's the city law that these two musicians, these two homeless musicians are accused of violating.
There's some attempt to punish homeless people in particular with the enforcement of these laws.
And in fact, you've asked for copies of citations of similar cases in the past?
Yes, we have.
And you've been informed by Susan Barisoni, one of the city attorneys, that there are documents available. In fact, a whole bunch of documents.
Yeah, and kind of straying away from my conversations with Susan Barisoni, there's a whole gang of documents, and it's going to take a while to look through them all, so we'll see how that goes.
We've been talking with Jonathan Gettleman, a local attorney at law and a pro bono attorney for Anna Richardson. Any final comments before we allow you to leave the restaurant?
Two things. Two different subjects. First one is Anna Richardson. I talked to the public defender the other day, one of the public defenders who works in the court every day, and they have a case where a person who was charged with, well, who was given a similar one of these injunctions in 2005 for panhandling was just given another citation recently, and in a act of executive power, you might say, by the police department, they went to the court. As far as I know, the county attorney's office went to the court. The court found in absentia, without this person being there, that they did violate the court order. They were sentenced to over a 30-day civil commitment without being present, without the ability to consult an attorney.
By commitment, you don't mean a medical commitment. You mean jail, right?
I mean a commitment to stripes and bars. Without an attorney, without the ability to confront witnesses, without their presence, their very presence in the court while this was happening. And then they issued a warrant, and then the person was arrested and taken immediately to jail. That's my understanding of what happened. So,
do you know the name of this person?
I don't. And since I don't know the facts firsthand, I don't wouldn't even want to say it if I did. But the point is, this is a very dangerous procedure because it's not clear that when this injunction it does become permanent and is enforced, that the types of rights that we enjoy, most basic rights that we enjoy in this country, are going to be afforded to these people prior to their incarceration.
Assuming you're not an unlawful enemy combatant, of course, or whatever the new name Obama has for it.
Basically, there is no difference in the legal process these people are receiving than unlawful enemy combatants. I mean, at least unlawful enemy combatants are able to have some court process, even if it's a terrible court process.
Even if it takes 7 years in jail to get it.
Right. Well, I don't think anyone's getting 7 years over this, but nonetheless, 7 days. I mean, 7 minutes, it's jail.
So, your second point is?
Second point is just putting on everyone's radar, and I'll be back, with Robert in this issue. But we have a significant case, pesticide poisoning case in Moss Landing going. And Salinas tomorrow will be deposing the farmer and the pesticide applicator.
It's January 27th.
27th to 28th. This case involves very serious, deadly, toxic chemicals that are illegal to even possess without a permit. A lot of people in Moss Landing got hurt from these chemicals, and they were applied right across the street. We're really trying to change the way that agriculture is allowed to without much concern for residents poison their immediate surroundings. And so I hope that we can keep this on your radar as the case goes forward, because I think that there is a very significant precedent to be made from the decisions and rulings that will be occurring in this case.
How can people get more information on this? Is there a site on the website or something they can Google for?
Well, there's some background. If you punch in methyl bromide, and that's methylbromide, and moss landing, pesticides, moss landing, just a Google search. There's been a lot of press that's been going on for 2 years, so you can look it up that way. You can always call me at my office, 831-427-2658.
2650, in case you didn't catch the last digits. 831-427-2658. 2658, sorry, not 50. Thank you, Jonathan.
Hello, we're on the San Lorenzo Bridge. Before we continue walking over the San Lorenzo Bridge, that was Jonathan Gettleman, attorney for Anna Richardson, and also a person who was giving me some tips on his thoughts about how to protect the rights of street performers and people engaging in First Amendment-protected speech on Pacific Avenue from what I call the heckler's veto. I just got his permission, or I should say, I didn't really need his permission because it's a public document, but he had some concerns about publicizing it, but I think it's worth publicizing, and he doesn't really have any objection to it. This is the document that Attorney Gettleman wrote for Anna Richardson, defending her from the injunction that he talks about as being a dangerous procedure, because an injunction doesn't give you a benefit of an attorney unless an attorney volunteers. It doesn't give you really the benefit of a trial. It goes before a judge. It doesn't give you much benefit at all. It's really a form of summary judgment, almost. And here's what he writes in his brief. The city of Santa Cruz, by and through its council, bring this action in abatement against two homeless residents of Santa Cruz County, Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon, now called the defendants, alleging that their presence and actions have created a continuing public nuisance in downtown Santa Cruz, particularly around the commerce centers and business fronts of Pacific Avenue and adjoining areas. The most important thing for the court to note is that there is no precedent in case law for issuing a civil injunction against homeless persons for action necessary for basic survival. Plaintiff's request, that's the city attorney, is extraordinary in its breadth and intention. On March 20th, 2009, at the first preliminary injunction hearing, the court informed the plaintiffs, the city of Santa Cruz, the city attorney, that they failed to present sufficient facts to warrant a preliminary injunction. In support of its claim, the city attorney has come back and now alleges the following. The defendants have been cited for numerous violations of city ordinances related primarily to sleeping or camping in public. The city now presents 26 declarations. 22 of these declarations are offered by government employees. 4 declarations are offered by private citizens who are interested business managers. And here are the facts supporting the claim that these two should be declared a public nuisance or there should be an injunction issued against their having a right to sleep, not anywhere, but somewhere, at least in the downtown area, that one act of sleeping should essentially become contempt of court or a jailing offense. The facts now support the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction can be reduced to the declarations of 4 categories of people: Santa Cruz police officers, Santa Cruz public maintenance workers, postal employees, and private Pacific Avenue business management. 14 police officers presented declarations in support of the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction stating the basis of the citations they issued against defendants. The vast majority of these citations relate to public camping under Santa Cruz Municipal Code 6.36010, misstated as 6.36001. To get that together there, Jonathan. That's the sleeping ban, or actually that's both that's the sleeping ban, the camping ban, and the blanket ban altogether. 6.36010A is the sleeping ban. As a preliminary matter, it should be noted that, and I think what I'm going to do with this, since I know this probably has much more interest to me and those who are legally fascinated with such documents than you out there who are thinking, what the hell is all this legal talk? I'm going to put this online at Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, where I've been writing a couple of other stories. and people can review it, and I'll also provide some commentary. And just to give you a break from all this chatter, I'm going to put on some music, and also, of course, give you a chance to call in at 427-3772 if you have some thoughts or you're really, you know, falling asleep here, and you know, you still can sleep legally until 11, so keep that in mind, all you homeless folks out there. And I'll be here, 831-427-3772. Let's listen to a little musical interlude here, and I'll be back.
San Lorenzo Bridge. It's January 26, 2010.
Yeah, and Robert Norris is here on his function at this time.
And it's about 9:50.
Okay, it's very dark.
And we
under
have,
the Zocal
we have a,
Bridge.
An interrupting... What's your name, sir?
Darkness. Zap.
We call him Uncle Zap. And also we're speaking with...
Dreamcatcher.
Dreamcatcher, how is it you can play such a tuneful guitar with at least one string missing?
Because I can play with less because I play a dulcimer.
So you're familiar with how to make do with less.
Less, yes. The less I have, the more I don't need.
True enough. True enough.
Well, wait a minute.
I have something to say. I hope this gets over the airways.
All right.
That there is a mountain dulcimer handmade by someone very special in the White Building across from the Palomar Hotel that doesn't have the name of the creator on it like all the other pieces do. But my name is Dreamcatcher, and I've been playing a dulcimer just like that, a mountain dulcimer, since I was 17. And if someone wants to hear what that beautiful piece sounds like, I think I could get it to come through, maybe, if allowed. If not, I'd like to meet the person that made that, because that is a very beautiful piece. And I have a handmade piece by the special guy that makes them in Arkansas. And I have it down in a pawn shop safely in San Diego. And I'd like to retrieve it someday, just because I've seen that one in the window. And I would like to play it.
Give us an example of, well, I know your guitar can't really compete with the dulcimer, but on the other hand, you've been able to twang a few tunes out on this thing.
That is true. I think the guitar is probably a little better. It's an E-based instrument that I tune to a G. Okay, so that's kind of like what's not normal. And then I don't know my A, B, C, or D, E from my F. It's mostly 2, 4, 2, 0, 1, 2, 1, 0. Okay.
For those who know and for those who don't, well, you can just tune to another station. How about twanging out a few notes for
you? Well, twanging out a few notes. The only song I know is Frère Jacques.
Sonne le mattina, ding dang dong, ding dang dong. Are you sleeping? Are you sleeping, Brother John? Brother John, morning bells are ringing, morning bells are ringing. And there you have it. French and English singing on the San Lorenzo River on the Soquel Avenue Bridge. We've been talking with
Dreamcatcher at your service.
Thank you, Dreamcatcher. And if anybody has access to a mandolin, particularly the one in the window across from the Palomar.
A dulcimer.
Or anyone can remember which instrument we're talking about, a dulcimer. Do get in touch, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I'll pass on the word to Dreamcatcher, who can be found downtown on occasion.
Yes, that's true. I drink a lot of coffee. And I'm distinctly tall and goofy. I look like the typical long-haired Mikey freckle-faced type with a headband on with a spider on it.
423 Huff, and I'll get that dulcimer to him. Thank you.
Or just find out about the opportunity to even just touch it or hold it.
Fair enough. We're talking with, what's your name again, madam?
Brianna Brewer.
Of course. And Brianna, we've spoken to you before on the street. You've been racking up traffic tickets, or what's going on here?
Just unbelievably late parking tickets, but they're so expensive. They're $40 just for the first fee.
Right. It's gone up recently. And you've tried to get this change, but you were given the runaround?
The cold shoulder.
Tell me, I know we ran into you yesterday. What happened when you tried to do this, and what have you done?
I told them I have all of $400, and I really need to get my truck registered as well. But they would not make my fees lower and took basically three-quarters of my money, making it so I could not register my truck. So basically, I'm still fucked.
So what, you need your truck because you're using it for your work, or is this...
For life. I mean, transportation is...
And you live indoors.
Yeah.
But you think there may be a rent problem as well?
Oh, of course.
And what are you going to do there?
I'm not sure yet.
Are you...
Maybe I'll live in the truck.
Aha, that would be illegal in Santa Cruz. How long have you been in Santa Cruz?
For 2 years.
And have things gotten better or worse?
More expensive.
You sound like, though, you're more on top of it than you were a couple days ago or yesterday when I talked to you.
That's a good point. I mean, I've paid my parking tickets.
Well, so you kind of went through that. You did the dirty deed, and now you're without the money that you had before.
Yeah, now, and of course, and now I'm without registration still.
Anything
else?
No,
I had to do that to get registration, and it's frustrating.
Thank you. Thank you for that update.
Good night.
Good night, Brianna. And here at the front of New Leaf Market, we have extremely bright street lights. Plus, it looks like a very bright light right above the one of these sections of New Leaf Market.
And this has been mentioned by a number of people that the lights have been kind of super bright lights have been put on at different points along Pacific Avenue, supposedly to increase safety. Some residents have actually complained that they can't sleep with their with their shades down, or at least they have trouble sleeping, you know, in the normal course of events.
Yeah, the herbal body care, what is it, LAM, total body care. So you got four very bright street lights, street lamps, and then
cameras over there are looking at us.
Broad lights on the broad lights on the enclosed sidewalk cafe area that is chained off at night.
So we're down here on Pacific Avenue on Thursday, the 28th of January. It's around, I think so. And it's, 9:05. Weather isn't that cold. It's a little chilly. We're talking with
Ray.
Ray, you're in front of graphics here on the bench. You've probably been here more than an hour, of course, illegally.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to panhandle at night anyways.
No panhandle. I don't really see you, do you?
Well, we're in radio. You don't even know it's dark.
No, but... Well, you've blown the whole thing. But you say that you've been down here since dark, and nobody has volunteered anything, which is unusual, even after dark?
Yeah. You know, usually some people come up and offer me some food, and I've even had people come up and offer me money without asking people. And, you know, I pick people up for some change, and it's just like they just walk right by. I don't know.
It's peculiar also because yesterday was a very pretty day, a very, very warm, pleasant day for winter. Today isn't, you know, I haven't been out much, but it looks like it's not that cold, so.
Yeah, it was a little colder earlier, and then it just warmed back up, so I don't know if the sky's clear. It's not going to rain, anyways.
There seems to be, it's sparsely populated, but there are, I'd say, 15 people on each block or something.
Yeah. And they had that that rock concert show at the Catalyst. I seen them pull in. I was on my way back to camp, and I seen them driving by Rossi. One of those great big buses, those big $500,000, tour buses.
And they just didn't kick even down a quarter, right?
Well, they were going down the street.
They were going somewhere else.
Yeah. The streets were empty except for them and their semi.
Well, good luck. Any other reports?
Let me see. Not at this moment. Let me sort it out first.
Any reports of performers being told to move along or getting tickets?
Yesterday I went over there by Marini's where I was sitting by that one pole.
Uh-huh.
And they put another bench in, brand new bench. I didn't even notice.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And they put a bench, like, right between the pole and the bicycle, the locking thing right there. And then, like, maybe an hour later, one of the downtown guys came up and said that I had to move because it was illegal to panhandle there because I'd be 14 feet away from a bench.
Interesting location for a bench.
I see down here, so
A Marini's anti-panhandling bench.
Well, it's right there between Marini's and Del Williams,
So maybe the two of them have gotten together to a memorial anti-hobo bench.
And then she said it was because people were complaining they need more seating.
But actually, that gives you less seating because it means everywhere within 14 feet of the bench, no one can sit down.
Well, yeah. But
I guess it gives you three seats.
People that are,
can sit. For no more than an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
And interesting enough, there's no time limit on the sidewalk, just on the bench.
Huh. Well, I didn't know that.
You can sit on the sidewalk for as long as you like, except you can't have a display device.
Well, did you get bored in the wintertime when it's all rainy and stuff, and you guys sit around and just dream up all these ordinances and...
I think they're paranoid all the time, and that's where they cook them up for him.
Since I was here 10 years ago, they've got all these new ordinances and stuff, and they're like, like that. Like, you can sit on a bench for an hour, but then you have to move along.
You hear
I think it's an attempt to placate merchants and conservative residents. That's my usual stock response.
Okay. All righty.
Well, thank you, Ray. I'm going to roll on you.
Thank you, Robert. You have a good night, Joe.
All right. And there are about three or four folks in front of the New Leaf Corner, maybe five or six, and some backpacks on the Soquel side street next to Borders. Otherwise, streets are sparsely populated.
It's around, you know, three or four times a year during the winter. A little coffee never hurt. Right. Anything you want to report from the street that you think is of note?
Let me think about that a minute. But not, well, we had a murder. We recently had a double murder.
Someone you know? Or?
No, I did not.
I was actually
having a really good time when it happened, so, you know.
It's no skin off your nose.
It's correct.
Well, would you like to sign in for our studio audience?
Eric Knight.
All right, Eric, and... Well, keep us advised of any new things.
Santa Cruz, California.
Indeed it is. Thank you, Eric.
We're talking with the infamous Fish.
And Fish, you're in a housing, you're out of housing, you're on the streets, you're back in the house. What's going on?
I'm settling down in Santa Cruz.
And what kind of a profession do you see ahead of you?
I'm really good at sharpening knives. I do really well at sharpening knives.
A professional assassin, perhaps?
No, I wouldn't say assassin. I would say maybe a culinary knife sharpener.
I see. So you're going to sort of be a sushi chef, perhaps,
or just a knife sharpener. There's lots of businesses that make lots of money off sharpening knives.
Fair enough. Any word from your old associate Sam these days?
Actually, we're back together.
Uh-oh.
And she's at work.
And Fish and Sam were responsible for alerting us to the practice of discrimination that was happening at Jack's Hamburgers, which then actually changed as a consequence of public protest very quickly. And my hat's off to Connie Hutchinson, who is the co-owner of Jack's Hamburgers, who recognized the importance of treating everyone fairly and abandoned what seemed to have been a previous practice of not serving homeless people because she or others who were pressuring her didn't like the fact that they were across the street on the lawn of the Red Church.
Till 9.
Now, we're standing not half a block from the infamous Jack's, where at one time you were persona non grata, and then, in a strange turnabout, all became sweetness and light again. Are things still okay at Jack's?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Have you and Connie been dating?
No.
Okay, so Connie is the co-owner, and I'm kidding about that one.
Yeah. She did apologize to me, though, about kicking me out. Yeah.
Oh, really? Well, that's impressive.
Apologize to me.
Any other problems with stores downtown you want to mention that need their attitude worked on?
No, I think they're doing pretty good now. They accept money, even if it's from dirty hands now. They're not, I don't think they're too picky anymore.
The virtue of the bourgeoisie.
Yes, definitely.
Again, we've been talking with...
Fish.
Thanks, Fish. We're talking with...
Well, you can still find him. I'm Nick Delaney.
And Nick, you just came from the parking lot back of what was Badass Coffee. And now, I guess...
Across from the hamburger joint.
Across from Jack's Hamburgers.
Yeah, there's a bus stop in the...
And there's a parking lot. And you say there's an elderly man being, should we say, grilled by the host?
He's homeless. He's very decent looking. But he does look like he's seen some homeless days. But he's a nice guy. He's sitting there, and the hospitality guy's just standing over him, and I know...
Watching over him, perhaps, like guardian angels.
Well...
Or guards, perhaps.
With the accent...
Prison guards?
With the motion, like he's got a notepad in his hand, and he's looking to take something.
I'll go check it out.
I wonder what he's looking for, yeah.
Thank you, Nick. A little music en route to the incident. Sounds in the market. We're actually at the parking lot behind Badass Coffee, one of the many parking lots in Santa Cruz where it is illegal to loiter. You cannot actually be in a parking lot unless you're walking through or if you are parking or retrieving a vehicle. But I see no sign of the fabled elder with the host hovering over him, so I move on. You just notice a table illegally perched on the sidewalk next to the side of Total Fitness. At the edge of the farmer's market here on Lincoln Street, a political table with keep local taxes local sign here. All right. Petition. It's a park wildlife program. We have a public spirited
today.
A public spirited woman is. What are you doing, public spirited woman? What kind of work are you up to?
Right now, I am presenting the current California initiatives to our California voters. Thanks a lot.
And you're getting a lot of signatures?
Today, I've been very fortunate. However, I brought my table and chair so I'm comfortable.
Have you made for the rent, enough for the rent today?
Not really. Not really. I think today I'm receiving between 50 and 75 cents per signature, and the marijuana initiative is a freebie, meaning I'm presenting
it. This is the second better marijuana initiative,
right? This is the one that releases people from prison who have been incarcerated if they're nonviolent offenders.
Excellent.
Nice to see you.
And if a police officer tells you you're illegally setting up a display device, have him talk to me. Because... because she is within 10 feet of a building. Of course, anybody who sets up on the Lincoln Avenue sidewalk between Cedar and Pacific Avenue is within 10 feet of a building, if they're near a building at all. Beautiful sunny weather today.
And is this an example of how ordinary political activity is actually illegal under the existing laws in Santa Cruz? This woman had a table that was illegally situated because any table on any street other than Pacific Avenue that's near a business is illegal. You have to be more than 10 feet away from a building, and the sidewalks are about 10 feet wide. So I guess you can set up your table on top of your car. But this has been the case since at least 2002, and it has to be said, I haven't heard of tickets being issued for this offense on other streets, but the fact that it is illegal gives the police the option to do so. And we're not talking about an ancient 1904 law that has fallen into disuse, but an active law that is being used by citizen vigilantes to run off homeless people downtown, along with other ordinances like the so-called sleeping ban, the unreasonably disturbing noises ordinance, and so forth. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and you're listening to Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I am not going to be with you on Sunday because I will be in Detroit, assuming I'm ambulatory and walking around. I've been a little sick, so if I continue to improve, I'm going to get in one of those big white birds and head for Detroit. Not on my money. This is actually being paid for by the Homelessness Marathon, which is an annual event run by a guy called Jeremy Alderson, who is quite an advocate for homeless rights. It's a 14-hour long marathon, happens every year in February, starts at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday, February 23rd, and runs until 6 in the morning on Wednesday the 24th, and I'm going to be on in a couple hours in the middle of the thing. We're not sure when. I actually talked to him today, and he didn't have the exact schedule, but I'm supposed to give him a break so he can, take a comfort break of some kind. I'm going to run in there and grill the homeless advocates and chatter and so forth. And so you can stay tuned to either KUSP or Free Radio Santa Cruz. I know that Free Radio has voted to broadcast all but an hour of the Homelessness Marathon. And, of course, with my luck, it'll be the hour that I'm on. But nonetheless, it's also available online. If you Google for Homelessness Marathon, I think it may be streaming as well. I'm not sure about that, but you can also listen to it later. That's, again, going to be happening next week. And on Sunday, Thomas Levitt, maybe with some help from some other broadcasters, will be doing my Sunday Bathroom Spears broadside show. I'm not quite sure what he's going to cook up, whether he's going to whip out an old recycled show from a prior time or whether we're going to be, you know, doing something exciting, new and original now that the cat's away, the mice will play, you know, that sort of thing. So that's what's coming up on Friday. I'm looking now at an article by Mike Rhodes on Indie Bay / Central Valley. That's Santa Cruz, actually Central Valley Indie Media, www.indiemedia.org/Central Valley, which is a good website for covering Fresno homeless civil rights activities and other stuff in Fresno. This is a story by Mike Rhodes, who I've had on the show a number of times, and who was one of the main people who got together the Kincaid lawsuit. He's not a lawyer, he's an organizer, but he and his daughter were able to provide documentation that transit authorities and Fresno police were compacting and destroying homeless property. And that is in violation of both the state law and also the Constitution. And the homeless got a $2.3 million settlement as well as an injunction against the city and the, I guess, the transit authority for doing that. It's not the transit authority. It's the Caltran, I believe. And so I've always been hopeful that at some point we can get a similar action going against John Wallace and his Parks and Rec Ranger gang. But so far that hasn't happened. Here's a story he wrote about medical marijuana dispensary shutdown in Fresno. And before I read it, I'm going to take a brief musical break because I need to water down my throat here. But I will be back, and we'll be playing some of that and more. So don't go away.
I don't need you, I just like your company. Come and see me anytime, 'cause you know that you are free to come and go anytime, and I'll always let you be. I don't need you, I just like your company. I don't expect you to be anything but you. There are no rules here on what you should do, because you are so good to me. And I like your point of view. I don't expect you to be anything but you. And I will be your friend till the end. And I will love you no matter what you do. And I don't need you to be around me every moment. Just come and go as you please. Expect me to be anything but me. You always help me to feel so free, and you remind me of the good things and say, don't forget to smile. You never expect me to be anything but me. And I will be your friend till the end. Every moment, just come and go as you please. We'll always be friends, we'll always be friends.
like your company. Come and see me anytime, 'cause you know that you are free to come and go anytime, and I'll always let you be. 'Cause I don't need you, I just like your company. And I will be your friend till the end.
That was a song by Opal Sun, also known as Vision Song Valerie, an occasional street singer in Santa Cruz, and Huffster. A medical marijuana dispensary shut down in Fresno by Mike Rhodes. The last medical marijuana dispensary in the city of Fresno was closed on February 9th. Below is a, we're going to give, you're going to hear an audio report about this in a moment, but this is the story that he wrote, Mike Rhodes did. This morning, police arrested Rick Morse, the owner of MedMar, the last medical marijuana dispensary in the city of Fresno. Morse was arrested for violating a court order which closed about one dozen dispensaries in January. Sound a little familiar? You may remember in January, the City Council of Santa Cruz voted to ban all new medical marijuana applications. Although there was only one that was really being processed, or that was that actually was stalled way back in June, by another emergency medical marijuana dispensary application ban backed by Mayor Mike Rotkin. And that ban was extended in July, and it was extended again in January. This is a statewide medical marijuana dispensary reefer madness kind of prohibition mentality that is being used by local jurisdictions because Proposition 215 has passed through the courts, and courts are beginning to rule in things like, I believe it's the Kelly decision, that you have to allow people to have, actually, it's an unlimited amount of medical marijuana. There are no specific limits that can be set unless they're set by initiative. I think this is my understanding what the Kelly decision is. I think I have that, the name of that decision right. But there is generally a finding in the courts that medical marijuana is legal. So the cities are doing their best to zone it out or to severely restrict it. What bothers me is that there's no significant justification for any of this. Not traffic, not police calls, not, public safety area problems, not youth in the area suddenly being found being intoxicated on the deadly drug. You have the ironic spectacle of, wineries in the area demanding that the medical marijuana dispensary not go in because it'll lower the quality of the neighborhood. It'll make it because of the intoxicants that it provides. It's just, it's medieval thinking, and what bothers me is that so many people in Santa Cruz are buying it because people like Mike Rotkin and Don Lane of the city council are suggesting, we have to really investigate further whether we need another medical marijuana dispensary. You don't investigate whether you need another pharmacy. You don't investigate even whether you need another bar, although there have been new restrictions put in on bars, or whether you need another store that sells cigarettes. But as for medical marijuana dispensaries, where there's an extreme shortage of dispensaries, generally, there are only two, and there have been numerous complaints of profiteering and prices too high, people having to go all the way to other cities to buy. Anyway, medical marijuana dispensary shut down in Fresno. The city of Fresno's ordinance on medical marijuana dispensaries severely restricts their ability to operate legally. The ordinance says that dispensaries must comply with both state and federal law. Medical marijuana is legal under state law, but illegal under federal statutes. In January, a judge issued a preliminary injunction closing the dispensaries until the issue could be heard in court. All but one dispensary, MedMar, shut down. MedMar owner Rick Morse explained why. It appears there is some confusion in the ordinance. It says medical marijuana dispensaries are allowed as long as they comply with state and federal law. I assert that we are complying with state and federal law. Morse's son Brandon spoke to the media about his father's arrest. He said, "This morning, my father was illegally arrested by the city of Fresno. They executed an unconstitutionally void warrant for his arrest. Today, my father peacefully went with the authorities, and as of 12 noon, he has started a fast for justice. I've joined him in this fast, and we are asking for people across the city to pray for him." I, that's Mike Rhodes, spoke with several medical marijuana patients outside MedMar who spoke about the arrest. The first person preferred to remain anonymous. He said, "As soon as they close that, it affects everyone that needs medical cannabis. It's not just me. You've got thousands of people in Fresno now. Who are they hurting? They're hurting people that have legitimate medical reasons for this. They're saying their agenda is more important than a medical agenda. We're not breaking any laws. They are the ones that are breaking the law. They shouldn't be arresting him." A second medical marijuana patient outside MedMar had this to say: "This makes it to our people that are sick, that have been proven to be sick by their doctors. They can't get their medicines. How does that help the city of Fresno, keeping people that are sick and that are in pain from getting their medicine?" And here's a little bit of audio that the Mike Rhodes put up online.
"This morning, police arrested Rick Morse, the owner of MedMar, the last medical marijuana dispensary in the city of Fresno. Morse was arrested for violating a court order which closed about one dozen dispensaries last month. The city of Fresno's ordinance on medical marijuana dispensaries severely restricts their ability to operate legally."
So that actually is probably what I should have played instead of reading it, since in fact, Mike Rhodes is reading his own copy that he wrote for this story. But you can read a lot more. There are numerous additional references in this story. Photos of Morse's son, Brandon, Morse himself in orange pajamas and a bald-headed sheriff's deputy. Apparently, he was arraigned in Fresno County Superior Court on Wednesday the 10th. Judge Donald Franson set bail at $5,000. Morse was released from jail at 5 p.m. Both Morse and his son Brandon are on a fast they say will end when justice is served. Brandon Morse said, "I'm going to continue the fast until justice is resumed. The fact that the judge has allowed me to post bail is a good first step." Boy, some people are pleased with small favors. Rick Morse was arrested yesterday for contempt of court charges when he refused to close MedMar. This was to say yesterday, meaning on the February 9th. The last remaining medical marijuana dispensary in Fresno. Judge Franson warned Morse if he did not keep his store closed, he faces 5 days in jail and a $1,000 fine for every day the business is open. The case will resume in Fresno Superior Court on February 17th at 8:30 a.m. So what I should probably do while you're eagerly tuned to what I'm saying here is see if there's been any update on this. Let's see what we've got. Bender allowed to post gate. Judge confirms crackdown on Fresno Medicarwana Club. Here we go. 4 hours ago. Here's a latest news result. It was another contentious day in court Thursday for the owner of a medical marijuana dispensary in Fresno who keeps saying that a judge has no right to shut down his business. Judge Donald Franson turned down MedMar Clinic owner Rick Morse's motion on Thursday to have Franson disqualify himself from the case. Morse objected and kept talking until the judge asked him to be patient. Eventually, after numerous interruptions, Franson told Morse to return in a few weeks for a contempt hearing in which Franson will decide whether to send Morse to jail or fine him or both for violating Franson's order that shut down every pot dispensary in the city. I think probably the judge should be arrested for depriving people of their medicine. That's my view. Morse says judges have overstepped their legal bounds by ordering the shutdown. That's the brief KMJN News Talk radio blurb on this case. And I'm looking to see if there's anything else. I don't see a lot more. There's some earlier background. But, you know, the prohibitionist mentality is spreading, and it's something that has to be fought, and I hope we're going to fight it here in Santa Cruz. But I don't know. Anita Henry has been on the show, so has Craig Canada, suggesting people get in touch with her. 425-3345 is her number in case you want to stand up against the prohibition here in Santa Cruz, which is what's going on. I should also mention that Measure K, I don't know if I mentioned this last show or not, the Measure K Commission is the commission that's supposed to make sure that every use of marijuana, medical or otherwise, by private individuals, or I should say by adults in private places, on private property, that is, are the lowest enforcement priority of the police, Santa Cruz police. I've talked about this issue at great length. I've written about it on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Indie Media. This commission has been defanged. It's been packed with essentially pro-police supporters who don't want to spend any money at all on doing their job, which is to look over police reports and find out whether police are, in fact, making medical marijuana arrests the lowest priority, lowest enforcement priority. They're not doing that. Instead, they've said they're just taking the word of the police department. And there was a meeting that was long delayed. They have a meeting every 6 months. And they met in January, and I didn't get to the meeting. And the individual that I hope would get to the meeting was too busy to go and videotape it. He did a great job videotaping past meetings, but this one he couldn't get to. And they're supposed to keep an audio record of the meeting. They're supposed to record it. Well, when I contacted Tina Scholl, who's the staff person, who sort of the police officer's agent inside the Measure K Commission, although they're actually all pretty much, except for Anita Henry and possibly one or two other members of that commission, either oblivious to or sympathetic to the police department instead of being the watchdogs that they are supposed to be. Scholl told me sort of in passing, oh, we didn't make a copy of that particular meeting because our equipment just didn't work. So there is no record of the last Measure K committee meeting. That happened previously, either at the meeting in June or the meeting in January. They again claimed, perhaps truthfully, that the equipment didn't work. But, of course, all that they have to do is fail to replace or repair the equipment, and it won't work. They've known about it for months that they have bad equipment. In fact, under increasing pressure, the Downtown Commission replaced archaic recording equipment or defective recording equipment, partially to stop me from coming into their office and making my own recording of their material under a Public Records Act request. And I don't understand why the Measure K committee didn't use that new equipment the Downtown Commission has. I've sent a request to Tina Scholl to tell me just what's happening, but I'm not expecting a response from her anytime soon. Although, it is her responsibility to get back to me. So, that's what's happening in Santa Cruz as the police department's anti-marijuana mentality deepens, and that permeates the Santa Cruz political process. I've got some other things I wanted to bring up. There was an interesting article from Portland, but before I get into that, let's hear a little more from the street.
A lot of smiles, a lot of pats and hugs and that sort of thing. And, of course, we have Cal doing some playing on his...
Thank you.
And Cal's guitar, that steel string guitar, was stolen a week or two ago. I don't know if he's gotten it back or he's gotten some replacement. He was really looking downhearted when he passed me on the street the other day.
We're talking with the latest fan of Vice Mayor Ryan Coonerty. Your name, madam?
I'm Renee.
And Renee, are you here? You're drinking coffee, but this coffee you didn't bring, right? Somebody else brought it?
Yeah, my friend Sean McMasters and Jacob Wickersham.
So you've been encouraging this kind of enabling coffee behavior.
Absolutely.
Well, don't you realize that you're doing it at the wrong time? In order to facilitate the sleeping ban, you need to do it at 11 o'clock at night so people can stay awake all night and obey the law.
Well, Well, you got to talk to them about that. Hey, but you know what? Father Joel let them brew the coffee in the kitchen. I'm so proud of him.
Did Councilmember Matthews, who owns property across the street, know about that?
I don't know, but she might now. You better edit.
Yes. Well, let me ask you about the vice mayor. You say that he is a, quote, real nice guy.
Yes, I really like him. I really, really like him.
Well, I saw the two of you.
We're talking about Ryan Coonerty, who's the son in the Coonerty clan, which owns the bookshop Santa Cruz and the author of a number of anti-homeless laws in downtown Santa Cruz, as well as the co-founder of Next Space with the virulently anti-homeless Jeremy Nooner.
Yes.
Completely schmaltzing it up over a cup of something at the, what was that, the coffee roasting company the other day. What decisions did you come to?
The two of us and my husband.
Yes. Well, your husband was present as a chaperone. You never can tell what old Vice Mayor Coonerty's got in mind.
I don't think we came to any decisions, although it's going to be harder for me to do what I do, knowing that he's not happy with it, because he's such a nice guy.
I see. So you would rather he be happy, but on the other hand, if that means not feeding anybody on Sunday, you probably don't want to do that.
No, I can't not do that.
So in other words, you're prepared to disappoint Vice Mayor Coonerty simply to help some ragamuffins downtown.
Yeah, it's hard, but true.
That doesn't speak well for your political savvy, Ronnie.
But I'm not political, Robert.
What about your religious adherence to the authorities of this world? He is indeed the vice, and I do mean vice, mayor of Santa Cruz. I got her on that one, folks.
I'm trying to figure out how to word this.
Render unto Rotkins what shall be Rotkins.
God is a higher authority than even Ryan Coonerty.
Oh, now that kind of, you know, idle chatter gets us nowhere. If you want a society where people pay attention to the rules and show some respect for law and order, after all, we have knifings, shootings, drug deals, gang violence. I mean, what kind of a society are you suggesting?
Okay, wait, you just said, like, several things. Back to Ryan Coonerty, I just want to say that...
I'm not suggesting he's the head of any local gang, except for... Well, we won't get into that.
If I'm violating the law of the land, it's because the higher law is love of these people, which are more important than whether or not somebody's uncomfortable because they can see them on the avenue on a Sunday afternoon.
Is that the reason you're violating at least two ordinances? One, putting your foot on public property. You, standing on this public property. And three, standing inside a parking lot while not retrieving or parking a vehicle.
We also have our tables and chess set and chairs set up in the middle of the parking. Well, not quite in the middle. We try to be considerate of the cars.
But whatever you do, don't start singing. That's another ticket.
I think we have sanctuary at the drum circle.
So you're allowing a band of criminals to surround and protect you, eh?
Do you think they're criminals? They're not the ones that are doing all this violent activity we've been hearing in the news.
But they are the criminals who are doing the rhythmic activities illegally in the drum circle, here in the parking lot. Why don't they just rent a hall? In fact, why don't you take your food and rent a room somewhere?
What are they doing illegally?
They're spending time in the parking lot without parking or retrieving a vehicle.
Oh. Well, nobody's bothering them, though. The cops don't come down and chase them away, so in a sense, by looking the other way, they're kind of saying, it's okay to be here. It's like the one little corner of the town that...
Where a brief afternoon is free at last.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, they did try to move everybody, but they wouldn't go. Now, perhaps you can help them in the next effort to move people out of here.
Probably not.
Particularly since you have to move yourself out as well.
I like them. But I really I do really like Ryan. I do. When I'm looking at the panel of the city council members, he's the one that stands out to me that has some personality there. I think I do.
Well, everybody has their own taste. I got to tell you that, Ryan. All right. Well, anything you want to conclude with before we leave?
Marcel, do you have any words for Robert?
I don't. I'm hungry. No comment.
A hungry drummer.
And we're out of donuts. We're clean out of donuts.
There you go. Disappointment. Thank you.
And that was, I think, Wednesday before last, or possibly two Wednesdays before last. It was, I think it was the first Wednesday in February, at the Drum Circle in the Farmer's Market, parking lot number 4, next to the Farmer's Market. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Coming up soon is an interview, which I think Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcaster Coral, is it Reef, Brune, or... Coral Reef, who's going to be, he's in the studio actually overseeing the situation. She's going to hijack part of my show in order to engage in some questionable interview with some characters down in San Diego, which she will explain in much more detail if they call in. But until that happens, here's an article from Street Roots, which is a Portland, Oregon homeless paper, one of the better papers in the country. Portland homeless people have been fighting and protesting, as have homeless people in other cities, Santa Cruz included, to change the sleeping ban laws that make it illegal for homeless people to sleep, period, at night after, well, in Santa Cruz, it's after 11 o'clock at night. In Portland, let's see what the law is there. I think, I don't actually have a copy of the Portland law, but I think it's similar to that, although it may just be at night after dark, and it may have some slightly different criteria. But there has been a lawsuit filed, and there were also some settlement talks happening and some guidelines for homeless campsites that were supposedly coming to the Portland, Oregon City Council. Here's the Street Roots story on it by Amanda Waldrup. As of late January, the settlement negotiations to a year-old class-action lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of Portland's camping ordinance have stalled with litigation proceeding. I'd very much hoped that the settlement would be in place right now, given that it's winter and it's cold and people are outside, and it's miserable, says Monica Garaki with the Oregon Law Center, which filed the case in December 2008 on behalf of 7 plaintiffs. We in the city attorney's office worked very hard to come up with what we feel is a reasonable settlement, and I still hope we can reach agreement. But we are fully prepared to litigate this case if necessary. But the city attorney in charge of that case and City Commissioner Nick Fish say that negotiations to end the lawsuit are not dead, and new guidelines dictating permissible camping should become city policy in 2 weeks. This is an article that was written on February 5th, and I think I'm going to be reading a subsequent article which essentially shows that this was either a very optimistic or a bogus prediction. Fish said that he is working with Dan Saltzman, the commissioner in charge of the Portland Police Bureau, on setting new camping guidelines. I think it is quite likely that these guidelines will be the basis of a settlement to the federal lawsuit, Fish said. The plan is to test drive them first, Fish said. It is my hope they will provide a framework for settling the lawsuit. Camps that are 4 people or smaller, out of earshot and sight of other camps, or 50 yards away, and are not loud or causing health or safety sanitation problems, would be allowed on public property between 9 a.m. and 7 a.m. Well, that's a longer period of time than Santa Cruz prohibits sleeping at night. Santa Cruz prohibits it from 11 to 8:30 in the morning. This would allow it between 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. I think there's a similar allowance of sleeping on the sidewalks in Los Angeles and in San Diego, two of the largest cities in California. The police also could not, under the proposed guidelines in Portland, Oregon, enforce the anti-camping ordinance against people sleeping in their cars. The guidelines would be a significant shift away from current policy, which make it illegal for any person to camp on public property. Advocates say Portland's current anti-camping ordinance makes it difficult, if not impossible, for homeless individuals to get a good night's sleep, which in turn affects their health and stability to take steps to find housing. That effect on homeless individuals makes the ordinance the subject of a class action lawsuit from the Oregon Law Center challenging the constitutionality of the ordinance on the basis that it violates the Eighth Amendment and cruelly and unusually punishes homeless people. For the last 6 months, the city and Oregon Law Center have been attempting to settle the case out of court. Commissioner Fish convened a task force led by the Portland Housing Bureau's Ending Homelessness Program manager, Sally Erickson, to create policy recommendations that would allow people without access to shelter to camp outside, get a good night's sleep, and escape the weather. StreetRoots board member and vendor Leo Rhodes also sat on the committee. Ironically, Rhodes received two park exclusions for camping during the month of January, which he is appealing. The recommendations from the Housing Bureau became the basis of conversations to settle the lawsuit. But parallel to settling the lawsuit, the policy conversations still took place, the idea being, Fish says, that the way Portland allows homeless people to camp would change one way or the other. I don't think not having a settlement means we can't talk about public policy issues around camping, said Mark Jolin, the executive director of the outreach agency JOIN. I think it would be disappointing if they couldn't reach a settlement. There has been no collapse of the settlement process, Fish says. Fish is currently working with City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who oversees the police bureau, to finalize the guidelines, saying there is broad agreement on most points. I'm going to kind of skip down here, yada, yada, yada. The new guidelines would not become permanent policy. There isn't political support inside City Hall to do that. They'd just be a sort of a six-month trial. A key sticking point is that defining the exact size of a camp. The guidelines currently say camps no larger than four people will be permissible, but does that mean the tent capacity for four people or the actual number of people? Another sticking point, where people would be allowed to camp. The agreement currently says the ordinance would not be enforced against people camping on public property that is currently open to the public. There won't be much capacity because that would exclude areas underneath bridges and privately owned land where people commonly sleep. The obvious solution would be to create a list of places where people could sleep. The fear is this would effectively create green zones. I haven't solved that question. I can see both sides. Of course, this is a guy who sleeps at night inside a building somewhere, inside his home. The settlement stalling comes at the same time that a large camp gathered underneath the Burnside Bridge until a police sweep the night of January 22nd. At a February 1st meeting of the Sharing Public Sidewalks Advisory Committee, an advisory group of the city commissioner said that 50 to 100 people have been camping underneath the bridge since November. Along with the increasing number of people came drug use, violence, trash, weapons, disorderly conduct, and other behaviors that provoked 313 calls to the police between November 20th and January 20th. Note, however, this is my addition, we don't have any specifics about citations for these illegal activities. So people can complain a lot because they don't like people camping, and they can claim drug use, violence, trash, weapons, and so forth. But if there's substance to these claims, you would think the police would actually have charges. We have the same problem in Santa Cruz, for example. If you look at stories in the Sentinel over the last week, and I talked to Jim Brown of the Sentinel today about this issue, he doesn't have any stats from the police department about the number of actual charges being issued against people downtown for real violations such as violence, burglary, theft, assault, and so forth. Instead, you get, of course, this crazy quilt of laws that essentially criminalizes all kinds of innocent behavior, like sitting, sleeping, spare changing, political tabling, and street performing. It's important to look at the details as to what's going on, because the people who want to run the homeless people out are really pretty casual and, frankly, slanderous in their use of terminology to describe what's going on. They describe as a public safety issue somebody sitting next to a building. That obviously has nothing to do with public safety. When Jeremy Nooner comes down and screams at someone sitting on a bench outside Next Space and calls him, "you faggot drug dealer," as he is recorded as doing on tape, and screams that you've been on the bench for more than an hour, and that becomes the basis for a criminal charge, we're entering a wholly new kind of twilight zone in Santa Cruz. And that twilight zone is being masked and whited out by the implication that this is a safety issue. Yeah, it's a homeless safety issue. Homeless people are getting harassed and essentially assaulted by people who are in businesses and being protected by the police under this kind of situation. The four of us who got tickets for singing faced a similar kind of situation where we were doing what had been done for years in front of that spot, singing a song, a political song, and getting ticketed for it, though we weren't singing at any volume any different than we'd ever sung at. Anyway, they're in Portland, their negotiations seem to be stalled, and it looks like Coral's call may be incoming. Let's see if that's actually happening. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, is Coral there?
Yeah, she is.
Maro calling in.
Hey, Maro. I hear you. Hello.
Hi, Coral.
Hi.
What's your plan?
Well, we're on the air, so I'm here. It's the end of Robert's show.
Hold it, folks. I'm going to sign off. Caller, hang on just a second. We'll put you and Coral through to discuss your issue. I want to
thank you.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Hang on for just a second. So for folks who are interested in following the homelessness marathon, do check it out. It's going to be at Google for the homelessness marathon. And I will also be, hopefully Thomas Levitt will be discussing this issue on Sunday when I come back. And that'll be actually when he comes back at 9:30 in the morning. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Take it away, Coral, and
this is Maro.
And Maro, thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, Coral.
Hi. I've been trying to briefly read up on what you've written and the websites of Rosalind and of, I don't have anything with Dane, but why don't you tell me what's going on right now?
Well, there's so much available evidence. When I called in earlier today, what I was talking about was what mainstream media was putting out now after Copenhagen. The international idea that we can technologically fix our climate.
Yeah.
Now, whether you believe in climate change or not, there's a plan in place, and it's reaching the last phases of the red tape. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, the United States passed a couple weather modification laws that actually allow them to do experimentation and weather modification on the on the population of our country. So really, the things that need to get worked out at this point are international agreements of crossing borders, because they're planning on using jets, and they say things like missiles and balloons, but really jets has been the method of choice for the delivery of aerosols in military experiments. And, of course, what we see in the sky today with the crisscrossing of the aerosols coming out of the jet engines.
There's been videos showing that they've released them. Is that what?
Well, on geoengineeringwatch.org, there are several shots that are being linked to American Skywatch. And they were taken by Tom Slate, and they're just one of hundreds that have since surfaced. You probably know Gerard Ungerman. He did The Oil Factor and Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. Yeah, well, he's got a whole bunch of footage. I got it with me. We haven't even had a chance to look at it. It just came by Federal Express, of fast motion footage, or what do you call it, time footage of jet trails, and a lot of starting and stopping. And the ones off my website, you can see them start the trail and then clean their sprayers, just like a painter would clean his spray guns at the end of the day to, you know, get the paint out of the jets. And you can see this as clear as day. You can see them start and stop. And, of course, everybody's by now seeing big U's in the sky where the planes turn around. You're looking at a KC-135, KC-10, probably flying out of Pinal Air Park. They used to fly out of Magoo and Beal. And they're part of a program to deflect. It's called SRM, Solar Radiation Management, is the new keyword. It's the official word. It's the declassified word. It's the word that Brian Williams, MSNBC, has told you about, because they're going to begin the program of sulfur aerosol spraying. What we've been looking at is barium and aluminum spraying. Now, that is another issue that has brought people that the conspiracy theories like chemtrail theories or several other quick names that don't really have any research behind it, because people who research it quickly find out that the levels of aerosols landing on the planet, landing in the water, have been going up in aluminum, barium. There's even now showing of an arsenic spike. Even the Department of Energy, I went down to see them. They recognize that California's Department of Energy, California Energy Commission, that was it. I was at that meeting where they were going to spend $250,000 to get Scripps Hole Institute to give them, to make them a device to tell them which aerosol was screwing up the rainfall. And we saw this in their minutes, and we go, what? What's that? So the thing is, they recognize that aerosol pollution is decreasing precipitation in the Sierras, and it's interfering with their ability to make hydroelectric power. They need rain to get the rivers swollen and to get the turbines turning. So they were having this meeting to approve this money, and we went down there and we brought all these water tests where we're showing what the aerosols are. We have, and I'm sure, you know, I can let Rosalind go into this more. Is she coming on?
She may be calling in about 8:05 for 10 minutes or so.
Okay, well, I'll prep her up a little bit with the test that have been done in Northern California, Australia. They're showing up everywhere, and it's really easy to test, folks.
When it rains, water tests.
Let's just say a rain test. You get a nice clean mason jar, and if you have any doubts, sterilize it, but that's not even necessary. Just wash it out and, you know, don't have any residues of anything in it. And when it starts to rain, put it out. And put it out and capture, you know, put a few of them out and then put all that water together. Unless you're going to have a rain where you got like two, three inches of it, then you only need one. But you need to capture enough to get about a half a cup of glass, at least. And you're going to take that rainwater down to a place to test well water, or another lab that's state certified, and you're going to spend $20 and say, is there aluminum in it? Now, the aluminum should be fairly non-detectable in rain. And Francis Mangles, a scientist up where we are, and one of many USDA scientists, says that number should be one or less, and one is really high. In one rainwater, there should be one part per billion of aluminum or less, and that's high. Yeah. So what we're finding is 276 parts per billion, 350 parts per billion, that many different landowners tested. Recently, a fourth grade class tested with a HEPA filter, tested the filter with a swab, which tested 191 aluminum. The barium was 8 on that, and there was strontium in it, 0.8. The highest test we had was 3,440 parts per billion of aluminum, and that was the day that 1,200 lightning strikes happened. 1,200 fires were going. There was like 6,500 lightning strikes. And Schwarzenegger himself said, we have never seen anything like this. The most we have ever had to deal with at any one time was 70. And all of a sudden we have 1,200. That day was the most charged day. And we have over 50 of our own tests. Rosalind Peterson has pulled up the state tests that show the same thing. Since 91, aluminum, barium, strontium, sulfur hexafluoride, manganese are all rising up and spiking. And that date correlates with a huge patent called the Wells Box Seeding Patent. And you can go to our website, click on the link of the patent, and it'll take you to the United States Government Patent Office and read it, folks. Yeah. They're saying that they're taking jet engine exhaust, putting aluminum, barium for the purpose of spraying aerosols to reflect the sunlight. Now they're telling you, MSNBC and everybody in Copenhagen, that we're going to begin the stratospheric aerosol geoengineering program. That is short for chem. That is long for chemtrails. What's that?
Go ahead, but I was reading that it's taking longer to deflect the sunlight. It takes a lot more year. I can't find the notes. A lot longer than is efficient to correct the global warming effects of the sun.
Well, if you've noticed lately, in the last week, in fact, today, I've been getting phone calls up and down the coast of just how hard they're hammering everybody right now, and you see how warm it is. right now. And in the nighttime temperatures, you know, you have people arguing back and forth whether this global warming happened. Look, it's getting colder here. It doesn't matter which side you are on this. People should be fighting this as if there was a pillow over your head, because they want to reduce sunlight. And they're telling you right now, New York Times, Rolling Stone magazine, everybody's put out an article, about 300 since November 1st, and they're on my website, geoengineeringwatch.org. The articles are non-biased. I throw them up as they come out on the left-hand side in blue. In the right-hand side is my research. But on the left-hand side, I'm just giving you what they are telling you.
And you are now at the AAAS conference, American Association of Advancement of Science. Have you seen people... has it begun today? Is it?
Yes, it began today. We have a lot of people coming in from different spots. Mm-hmm. It's $350, $400 to get in there. So,
you brought a
contingent
from Northern California with you?
We traveled 10 hours mm-hmm. already, and there's 15 of us. People are coming in from Arizona and Nevada. And yeah. Hopefully people are coming in from everywhere. And this is the start of it. Rosalind told me one day, you know, Marl, these people, these scientists, have never been confronted yet. Well, they've never been confronted because they've been sliding under the carpet everywhere. And they were even hiding geoengineering terms. But the fact is, they're telling everybody right now they want to deploy a program that will cut 34% sunlight at peak. 34% sunlight, you and I won't be able to grow our crops. We'll have to use genetically modified seed that works with not only lesser sunlight but higher concentrations of aluminum and sulfur, mm-hmm. and you know what God gave us won't work anymore.
And I heard
yeah, go ahead.
This all started with the nuclear weapons era when they thought they could be used for.
Interestingly enough, this is Edward Teller's idea many years ago. Edward Teller invented the hydrogen bomb.
Yeah,
and this was his idea, and this is that. That guy also, before he died, suggested that we make some artificial harbors up in Alaska detonating hydrogen bombs. And we need a cove there? Hey, well, let's just gouge it out one shot. And he was also the co-inventor of Star Wars with Lowell Howard. And they there was a huge corruption around that because, you know, they were trying to get the funding. And basically, it wasn't a viable system. It's a system that could be taken out early. But who wants to have that kind of plutonium flying over our heads all the time? It's insane. These guys don't think about stuff like that. And now, Loa Wood, who's part of that, is teamed up with Caldera and Gates as consultants and beyond, because Gates is patenting with Caldera on geoengineering projects. Gates has put $5 or $6 million in. Now, this is a guy who, like, you know, does many good things on the planet in many people's eyes, but he's also into vaccines, and I'm not. And if we'd all taken that H1N1 vaccine, hey, how stupid would we all look now?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, these guys have an agenda. And the agenda now is to control the planet. And it's so easy to control the planet if you control the weather. They want a one-world government, and who they is all you have to do is follow the money. Look to the banks, look through the banks, because it will be so easy. And this is why this systems arc exists. It would be so easy to make Russia or China surrender if they have no way of growing food for themselves.
What would you say to people who don't really... you're telling them go to your website because you have done a lot of research, and people that just don't think that this is quite what you're making it out to be.
Well, what I would say is read what Brian Williams... There's a little video show of Brian Williams' show on the day after Christmas. That's the day he told you. You'll find New York Times articles, National Geographic, Science Magazine. And actually go back all the way to my first post to read MSNBC, CBS, and read backwards. And you'll see where the words went, hey, this is a last resort. We would never think of doing this without a lot of experimentation. And by the way, we're not even asking you. And to where they're saying now is we have the money. The kind of experimentation we do is a global 10-year ramped-up full deployment program. And the same guys who are saying that this could be very risky are also saying, yeah, but let's do it. And mm-hmm. also, while you're there, go to the AAAS section of the website where they talk about the protest and read the three-legged stool. That's their own words on what they think of you and me, just how much they value our opinion. It does, you'll see they state in there that the population makes their decisions on emotions and spiritual beliefs and not logic. And since we trump them with logic, there's no real reason to concern ourselves with bringing scientifically up to speed. Now, are you there still?
Yeah, I am. I watched.
Okay,
yeah.
So I don't know about you, but if they're going to put something into the air that we have to breathe, that is going to, it can't be stopped, and is going to go up for 10 years at least, and then they're saying they can't stop it because the runaway from the stopping it will be greater than if they ever did it. Robach said that recently, and he works with science. He is a geoengineering. They're telling you the truth about this. And it's one time when it's all laid out for you, and now it's for us to decide. They've laid it out, and we are going to decide. But they're not going to tell us if we start or stop. What we have to decide is, are we going to let them?
Right. So we're not going to let them.
That's right. And just ask people to read their own words.
Mm-hmm.
And then come over and read some of the research we did. You know, I wanted to think Ken Caldera was a good guy, just a misguided scientist. But the man sat around at Livermore and admits, and we have the audio tape of sitting around, and I say sitting around because that's the actual term he used, and I don't have my computer on, and we've been driving so long, so I don't know the exact phrase, but he's telling you that they used to think of ways to turn a weather modification into a weapon. And beyond, I mean, Keller, Lowell Wood, Caldera at Lawrence Livermore with a huge budget that you and I pay for and the freedom to think. Imagine where those guys went with this. And a lot of those things got created. And now they're turning around, the same guy saying, trust me.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds...
And if you don't believe in global warming, by God, you ought to be on the streets with us on Saturday morning because this already should be off, checked off with big red on your list of things to do.
Well,
I would love to see the teabaggers there. There's every reason in the world for them to be there.
Yeah.
Hey, that's not politically correct anymore, as to say that. I apologize for that if I offended anybody.
Oh, yeah, this is a politically correct station, for sure.
And we're going to start off on Saturday with a prayer. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of people coming in. I'm so tired, folks. I've been the lead organizer on this for a week, and I've been sleeping for like 2 hours.
Tell everyone what you've been doing as an organizer.
I dove into this thing when I heard that the scientists were coming to the West Coast.
Right.
And I've been watching this for a long time. I've been a chemtrail activist for many years and wondered just why can't people read the data? There's a patent there that says everything, that these tests are matched. And it sure matches in the sky with what I was.
Especially where you are.
Yeah, well, planes used to disappear. The jet trails behind them. I'm 50 years old. Mm-hmm. I remember we laid on our backs as kids, and they don't do that anymore. The very first one that I saw, 98, made me sick. I'm like, what the heck was that? And that was a foreboding of what is here today. And here I am going south with my dearest buddies who understand the urgency of this situation, that we drive this into the public awareness. No matter what we have to do, we have to drive this up into over the radar. And there's still, you know, we can't count on media to do it because the way they've already done it, they can turn around and say, well, we told you, but they didn't tell us, and neither are the scientists with the emotion and the urgency that this situation requires. If global warming is so bad that you must do this, why are you not screaming as a scientist that we should be turning our backs on industry and Coca-Cola and Chevron and get a life or not have a life? No, they're not doing that. They're just going along with the whole program of letting fossil fuel industries and big government slowly steer us in the direction they want us to go, which is to create an artificial atmosphere that, hey, we can deforest more now because we just sprinkle a little bit more. We don't have to worry about that. Our logging will get worse. Solar industries, good luck with alternative energies with that happening. Ken Caldera even says, once we implement this, ground-based astronomers are going to hate us. Well, I already hate them. And it's not, you know, a real hate, that kind. I hate that they're not talking to us. In getting our opinion doesn't matter. And they tell you that in the three-legged stool there at the AAAS part of my website. They say we do not need to tell the public anything.
Yeah.
And they say, what an awkward situation for us. And we have to think of more clever ways of dealing with that. So please come down 7:30 in the morning to San Diego Convention Center and meet a lot of people with a lot of information, a lot of tests. There's people who've been testing their hair for years, showing aluminum raising. A guy named Curtis said he was going to meet me there with some of that. And, you know, I've been getting phone calls off the hook for days. And we emailed 15,000 people. We got caught as a spammer and had to fix our way around that. I mean, we are just babies, grassroots babies. But we were able to dive in because a few of us just knew. You know, even though we don't know where we're going, we're just going to say we're going to be there in San Diego when you're there, scientists. And we declared there'd be a protest. And it just fell together. It took a lot of people to make that happen. And, and even the police have been very happy to receive us down there because this is a very important issue.
Will there be anybody?
It's the most important issue.
That goes in? Someone that in your group going to go in the conference?
You can go in if you pay the money,
yeah.
And I don't want to say who it is,
yeah.
Because they've already kicked out a few people that we were surprised they would kick out that had excellent credentials, but I guess they didn't have a good feel for their sense of journalism, which is telling the truth. So there are other people going in that are climate researchers and doctors that are going in that really are going to be listening very closely to what they're saying. And we expect a full, transparent report from the AAAS, although I don't think by what I see on their page that they intend to do that. We will get the sound bites as they come out, but as the sound bites come out, we pick them apart at geoengineeringwatch.org with the help of a lot of people in this country that have scientific backgrounds, such as Rosalind Peterson, your next guest.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can get Dane Wigington on, too, who has led a movement up in Northern California to get people to test, see for themselves. And it's incredible the numbers we've been seeing, where one rainfall is one-third a year's amount of toxic-level rainfall, that line that would be toxic in one rainfall of aluminum or barium. Or some of them even worse. As that one was 3,440. That's like 3 or 4 years worth of accumulated aluminum.
Where was that taken at?
That was taken on the eastern arm of Shasta Lake, where there's hardly any residents. It's a beautiful one of the last little ice age forests in California. It's absolutely beautiful, but they hammer it up there. It's a sacrificial area. It's the same area where they built all the dams and took away the salmon. It's the same area where they clear-cut to hell and take all the trees. It's a sacrificial area, and they treat the people and the wildlife up there the same way. Hey, you know, spray hard, and whatever they learn from that, it's tied into, you know, many different programs. Weather modification is not the only thing that this is designed to do. And for people who want to hear more about that, you have to go down the rabbit hole on that one yourself, and I recommend starting at my site, and you'll just start finding information. HARP is tied to it. HARP is a weather modification apparatus, although it has many other layers. Raytheon, for example, built HARP. Raytheon also has the contract for giving the weather to the American Meteorological Service. When I was a kid, weathermen combined their skills and made a portrait of what the weather was going to be the next day, the next week. Now it is faxed to them by the AMS service, which is faxed to them by Raytheon. Raytheon is working with DARPA, Defense Atmospheric Research Program, something like that. Anyway, Raytheon's involved in weather modification, and they're also predicting the weather. So what we see is Raytheon is just telling us what the weather is going to be because they're going to be spraying and making it the way they think it's going to end up. And locally, they've done a very poor job. Weather reporting looks hilarious.
Mauro, I'm getting a call, right, and it's from Rosalind on my phone.
Okay, should I go?
Yeah, we'll wrap it up, and I'll be hearing from you again soon.
Okay, goodbye. God bless everybody.
We'll put some music on here. I expect that there'll be another caller from the Agriculture Defense Commission. Her name, Rosalind Peterson. If our communication didn't cross there. And she'll be talking for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have the rest of the evening's broadcasts, including cream from the cream to the dregs, which will be in progress. So thanks for listening, everybody. And if we get this call, then we'll be going back to the phones. Thanks. Free radio. Hello.
Hi, this is Rosalind Peterson.
Hey, good to hear you. Yeah, we just hung up with Morrow, so I'm glad you made the call, and it's good timing here, and you're on
the air.
Well,
I left you a message that the phone had been busy, so
yeah.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, we're on right now. We're on the air, so.
Okay.
I've been reading a little bit of your website, and Morrow filled me in about what's going on down south, the American Association of for the Advancement of Science Conference, AAAS, and you live in Mendocino, is that correct?
Mendocino County, that's correct.
Mendocino County. You're with the ADC, and you have, could you, I didn't read a whole lot about what you're doing recently, but you do, you have written a lot of articles, and there's one about California, I think the latest one was the one about California burning and the burn rules. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I can, actually. Yes, I'm with the Agriculture Defense Coalition, and one of my concerns has been about agriculture because I was an agricultural technologist for the United States Department of Agriculture, as well as the crop loss adjuster. And just recently, I've been researching smoke and how the tiny particles in smoke can reduce rainfall and cause drought.
Mm-hmm.
And this has led me to go into agriculture and backyard burning, which is permitted by the state of California. And, for example, there's 16,400 acres of grapes that are producing in Mendocino County. And when these grape growers prune, they burn all of the prunings, the clippings, anything they pull up out of the ground. In other words, when they pull up grapevines that they no longer want to use for crops, they burn everything. Plus, more and more backyard burning is allowed without a permit or with only minor infractions if you're burning on a no-burn day. And so what's happening in California is that more and more acreage by agriculture is being turned into burning, which has the effect, because of the small particles, of inducing drought. And a lot of the local county air quality districts make their money through fines and fees that they charge those that burn with, if they burn on a no-burn day, for example. However, I think that this is at cross purposes, because when they make their money through fees and fines, then they want to continue the practice because that's how they fund the districts to a certain extent. So we're mm-hmm. increasing the burning, and we could take a chipper, and instead of hours and hours of agriculture burning that pollutes the air, we have to breathe it, and it shortens your life, causes asthma in children, lots of health effects involved with burning. We could chip it in a matter of minutes. You can take a whole oak tree in a chipper, and you can chip it down in about 20 minutes flat. And I mean, this is a big one with a big three-foot diameter trunk. And yet we're not making arrangements at the state level to cut down on the burning, which would improve our air quality and our rainfall.
And since tonight we have just very little time, could you sum up what you think is going to happen at the AAAS conference down in San Diego, Roslyn?
Well, there's a group of geoengineers that are going to speak on Saturday at 8:30 in the morning, and they're going to be addressing schemes, not only, in other words, solar radiation management, which means stopping direct sunlight from reaching the Earth, reducing it, or using our oceans to put particulates in the oceans in order to iron dust, in order to create artificial algae blooms. They're talking about using solar umbrellas. They're talking about using, in other words, particles and chemicals in the air, all of which is to reduce sunlight that we need in order for us to have crop production, photosynthesis, functioning solar panels. Well, the geoengineers are not interested in having a public discussion at the university level or at any level. They want to have these hidden kind of meeting agendas, and they go and talk about the need. We need to do it and why we should do it, because we think that it's going to stop global warming. But we're not having any scientists, either at the congressional hearing, which was held on November 5th, 2009, we're not having public input. We're not having agricultural input. Solar panels could be negated from some of these plans to reduce, in other words, the sunlight from reaching the earth. We'll have a lack of vitamin D, more rickets in children. There's all kinds of consequences. Even honeybees navigate and communicate through UV radiation, the light that they receive, and they have a method of communicating and navigating. So when you have food pollinators and all of our crop pollinators could be impacted from, in other words, using our environment as a physics laboratory, and we don't know the consequences. And so with Bill Gates going to fund, and they're going to get funding, I'm sure, from Energy Secretary Chu's department as well, they're going to start getting funding to start experimenting with these programs. And what concerns me is that they're discussing this and talking more and more to people about how they must do it, even if they don't understand the consequences, which they admit, that they must go up and do these experiments. And I'm wondering where the debate is with the ocean scientists, agriculture, trees, everything. Life on Earth, in order to exist, needs photosynthesis. And when you start covering up your skies with cloud cover and stopping direct sunlight, you reduce photosynthesis and you lower crop production. And there's